You know, when Jesus died on the cross, everybody thought it was game over. But we know that Jesus wasn't done. It was still game on. And what happened 3 days later, nobody expected. Nobody expected what would happen 3 days later. And what happened changed everything. It changed the world. And nobody anticipated what would unfold. Nobody foresaw what would unfold. Nobody imagined that the tomb would be empty. And certainly nobody expected that Jesus would be alive, because that's not what happens to dead people. And yet, against all odds, against all expectations, 3 days later, unexpected happened. He is alive and the tomb is empty, and it brings a message of hope, renewal, and power. Nobody saw it. Nobody saw that the tomb would become a womb that would birth something new that had never been seen before, where we could enter into the family of God. Nobody thought this would happen like that. This is what makes Easter so special. This is why over 2 billion people will gather today to celebrate Jesus is alive. I guess we'll be over 2 billion people gather on this day to celebrate that Jesus is alive. That's over 30% of the world's population believes what we believe, that on that day, Jesus was resurrected from the dead, never to die again. We're not alone, although we're packed in here this morning. We are not alone. The churches across America are packed. Across America is packed. Around the world, we are not alone. There are a lot of people that are celebrating today because it's become a reality for us that Jesus is alive. And that's what the evidence shows. Let's read back through the account of Jesus' resurrection and just look at this afresh and anew this morning. John chapter 20, verses 1 and 2. Again, John is writing this and he says, "Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. She ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple." Now, you've got to realize that this other disciple is John. John is talking about himself. John is writing this. So he's saying she ran to Simon Peter and to the other disciple. That's to John who's writing this. "Whom Jesus loved." He put this in here. "Whom Jesus loved," right? Want to get that clear. "And said to them, 'They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they've laid him.'" Mary was not expecting that he would be alive. Mary was expecting that he would be dead and still in the tomb. That was her expectation. And she didn't know what had happened when she saw that his body was gone. Verse 3, "Peter therefore went out and the other disciple." Again, John talking about himself, right? "Peter went out and the other disciple were going to the tomb, and they ran together." And the other disciple, again, John talking about himself, outran Peter. Does anybody find that interesting? This is the most important story in history, in human history. And John wants us to know that he can outrun Peter. I'm just saying. Not only does he say it once in this text, he says it twice in this text. And we'll read it again. He outran Peter. He wants us to know that he can run faster. And I just love this because you get the group dynamics going on here, right? Now, what John doesn't put in his gospel is also very interesting. John does not put in his gospel that Jesus nicknamed him and his brother the Sons of Thunder because they wanted to call down fire on some people. So John doesn't put that in his gospel. And John doesn't put in there that that John found some people that were casting out demons in the name of Jesus that weren't with the group, and he told them to stop. John doesn't put that in his gospel. And you know what else John doesn't put in his gospel? John doesn't put in that the disciples were arguing numerous times over who was the greatest. In fact, John and his brother James went to Jesus privately and said, "Hey, can we sit on your left hand and your right hand in your kingdom when it comes? You know, give us special place." And so John doesn't put that in his gospel either. So there's some things that John left out. But out of those four things I just mentioned, three of them are found in Mark's gospel. Three of those four things I just mentioned that maybe don't show John in the greatest light are found in Mark's gospel. And where did Mark get his story from? From Peter. Peter, who can't run as fast as John. So I just love the group dynamic. I just love the story here. This is great. And so John wants us to know that he can run faster. And probably, you know, maybe I believe that Mark was written first. The scholars, you know, debate this and stuff, but I think it was written first. Maybe John had read the Gospel of Mark and thought he didn't paint me in such a great light. So I'm putting in there, I ran faster than than Peter. Touche. Anyways, I'm getting off topic here. Most important event in history, okay? We know that John can run faster, but that's not the big point here. Look at verses 5 and 6. And he, Peter, or I'm sorry, John here, got to the tomb first. And he, John, stooping down, looking in, saw the linen cloths lying there and yet did not go in. Now, interesting, in this text, we also have the word saw three times. And in the Greek, there are three different words. But in the English, it's just one. And so when John gets there and he stoops and he looks in, he just quickly looked and he just notices Jesus isn't there. The linen cloths are laying there. It's just a quick look. We go on to verse 6. It says, then Simon Peter came following him and went in the tomb and he saw the linen cloths lying there. So Peter goes down in and he sees this. And this is a different word than the first word. This means to theorize, to think. He's trying to figure it out. What just happened here? You ever wanted that? Something happened, or something's not right around the house, and you're looking, there's a big mess, or something happened. You're wondering what happened. You're trying to figure out who did this. What, you know. And so Peter goes down there and he's trying to figure this out. Okay, Jesus' body's not here. Cloths are laying here. Stone rolled away here. And he's trying to figure out what has happened. That's what Peter's doing. But in verse 7, and the handkerchief that had been around his head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded together in place. So he's noticing everything here and trying to figure it out. And then verse 8, then the other disciple, John here, talking about himself again, who came to the tomb first, ran faster than Peter, went in also and saw and believed. Different word in the Greek. He saw and he got the dots connected in his heart and in his mind, and he understood, Jesus had been talking about this. He's not here. He got it. He got it. The other disciple who came to the tomb first went in also and saw and believed. And verse 18 later says Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord and that he had spoken to her some things. And so later on the day, Jesus shows up to Mary and says some things to her, and then she goes to tell the disciples because they still don't know what's going on. In verse 19, then the evening had come, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut and where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews. So they're still hiding for fear. Jesus came and stood in the midst and said to them, peace be with you. And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. They believed. They saw him. But the resurrection was unexpected. This is not what they were expecting to happen. And yet, it did. And Jesus appears to them. And he shows himself. And there is good evidence to believe that Jesus was really resurrected. I mean, this does not happen to dead people. We know this. So why do we place our faith and trust in Jesus? Why do we believe this? I want to give you four reasons why we believe in the resurrection this morning. Four evidences for the resurrection. And you have these on the screen, and we're going to kind of go through these one by one. But we have the formation of early accounts. We have the firsthand testimony. We've got the empty tomb that you've got to deal with. And then you have the rise of the church. Why there's over 2 billion people today that are celebrating that Jesus is alive. So let's jump into the first one, the formation of the early accounts. Now, many people believe that the resurrection is a legend, that it's a myth, that something happened around 33 AD with Jesus' death, and that stories were developed and myths were made and legends were made, and then later, maybe 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years later, some things were written down that don't resemble the truth of what happened. But there's not this huge gap of time like some have believed in the past, that the stories were being written down much closer to the actual events. And this is what gives them a lot of credibility. We see this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 3. As Paul is writing this to the people at Corinth, he says, for what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance. He says this, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried and he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. That this was something that the early church had been quoting that had been saying. This was a creed of the early church that scholars have found go back to within the first 2 years of Jesus' resurrection. That they were saying this when they got together and they met, they would quote this. That Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. And Paul was simply passing on what the earliest Christians saw, what they believed, and then had been making creeds, developing creeds to tell the story and writing it down. And so this wasn't 50 years, 100 years later that this was written down. This was being spoken, written down 2 years, less than 2 years after Jesus' resurrection. Not a long enough time for it to be a myth or to be a legend. The second thing we have here is firsthand testimony. If we keep on in this text, we see that, and that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12. Talking about Jesus, how he appeared to Cephas, which is Peter, and then to the 12, his 12 disciples. And then verse 6, he says, after that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time. And Paul goes on, he says, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. He's like, if you don't believe me, you can go talk to many of them who are still alive about what they saw, about what they heard, about seeing him and talking with him and eating with him. If you don't believe me, go talk to them. There's over 500 that saw him at one time, alive. He says, like, you don't believe me, go talk to them. Over 500 firsthand testimonies of Jesus. And he appeared to them as alive. And he appeared to people, sometimes individuals, sometimes in a group setting. Sometimes it was indoors or outdoors. Sometimes it was to skeptics. He ate with them. He talked with them. He taught them over a period of 40 days. That we have testimony from that. He showed himself to skeptics like Thomas, who did not believe, would not believe until he saw him. And Jesus invited him to touch his wounds, to touch the hole in his side. And after being confronted with the resurrected Jesus, this doubting Thomas, who he's now known for, said, my God, my Lord and my God. That is what his response was, my Lord and my God. One of the greatest testimonies or confessions of faith that we have in the New Testament. And for what he saw and for what he believed, he went on to preach the gospel for the rest of his life until he was martyred for his faith. That's how real it was to him that he went into India, continued to preach the gospel until he was killed for his faith. Eyewitness testimonies. If we were to bring into the courtroom over 500 people who are firsthand testimony, who can provide firsthand testimony to the resurrected Jesus and let them sit up in the courtroom and testify for just 15 minutes each, we would be listening to firsthand testimony for over a week. That is a lot of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. I would say it's an avalanche of evidence. It is overwhelming. We could listen to over 128 hours if we just limited them to 15 minutes each of firsthand testimony to the resurrected Jesus. But we keep going. We got the empty tomb. Our next one is the empty tomb. And history tells us that Jesus was laid in a tomb of a prominent Jewish council member named Joseph of Arimathea. In verse 38 of John 19 says, later Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jewish leaders. And I just love this too. He was a secret follower of Jesus. He was a secret believer. He didn't want to be known that he was following Jesus, but he did. And the great thing, amazing thing about Joseph of Arimathea, you know what they do with bodies? Once somebody is crucified, they throw them on the burn pile. But because Joseph of Arimathea believed in him, and even though he was a secret believer, asked for his body, went and buried him in his tomb, this is the reason we have an empty tomb. If it wasn't for him taking the body or asking for it and taking it and then putting it in his tomb, Jesus's body would be thrown on a burn pile. There would be no empty tomb to talk about. But because he was willing to do this, we have an empty tomb. I love this about Joseph of Arimathea. Asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now Joseph was a disciple, but secretly because he feared the Jewish leaders, with Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away and he put it in his tomb. So there was a place for it and there was guards outside of it to make sure that nobody took it, nobody stole it. Luke 24 verses 1-3, it says, on the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb, right, expecting Jesus to be dead. And they found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. We have an empty tomb that has to be dealt with. Now, what's very interesting about the story is that the women found it. Now, if men were writing the story back in Jesus's day and trying to make this stuff up, they would never have women finding the empty tomb because women's testimony didn't matter in a court of law. And so you would never have a woman testifying to the empty tomb because their testimony would not be believed. You would have had a man if you were writing this, but the way God lines it up, women show up there first, they see the empty tomb, then they go get the men to bring them there. So if somebody was making this up, they would have written it differently. But here's the thing, everybody admits that there was an empty tomb. Not only did the disciples admit there's an empty tomb, but so did the Jewish leaders and the Roman authorities said that there was an empty tomb. And you have to deal with this empty tomb. How did it become empty? Because the disciples are not SEAL Team 6, friends. They are not gonna go somehow steal the body of Jesus from Roman authorities. And the Roman authorities had no motive to go steal Jesus's body. And surely the Jewish authorities had no motive to go steal Jesus's body. They both wanted them in the tomb. So you've got to deal with the question, how did the tomb get empty? Why is it empty? In fact, there's so much evidence for the empty tomb that people that don't believe had come up with all kinds of reasons why they think the tomb was empty. They've had attempts to discredit the resurrection because you have to, if you're intellectually honest, you've got to deal with why is the tomb empty? How did it become empty? And so there's several theories. There's four main theories that I'll give you quickly, briefly. The first one is the wrong tomb theory. Now, this could be they went to the wrong tomb. The ladies were upset. They're full of grief, and maybe everybody had been up late, you know, grieving and drinking too much, and they went to the wrong tomb. And maybe Peter and John, when they were, you know, ran there, they too, being upset and grieved by everything, went to the wrong tomb. I mean, I've gotten lost before and gotten to the wrong place or past the right place. So maybe it was the wrong tomb. But here's the thing. If they showed up at the wrong tomb, the only thing you have to do to disprove what they're saying is take them to the right tomb, open it up, and show them the body. I mean, that's as simple as that. So the wrong tomb theory just... it doesn't hold a lot of weight. It's just, it's easy to disprove. It's very fragile. And so it doesn't hold a lot of weight. Then the second one is the hallucination theory, that maybe they hallucinated that Jesus had been resurrected when really he had not been resurrected. And yeah, sure, you can have one person here, another person there having a hallucination, but again, 500 people saw him all at once. There's just no evidence for group hallucinations where everybody's there having the same hallucination. Are you guys with me? Just there's no modern day examples of that. They just don't happen. You know what I'm saying? So the hallucination theory just doesn't hold a lot of weight. Probably my favorite is the swoon theory, because if you think this is possible, it's just crazy. So the swoon theory is the idea that Jesus, after having been beaten badly, right, and being crucified on the cross and being up there for so long, and then stabbed under the ribs with a sword and having his heart basically pierced and blood flowing out, and then put in the tomb, that he really wasn't dead. He was just really badly hurt. And they thought he was dead. And now there is some evidence in history for burying people alive. They've excavated coffins where... In wartime, that people have been, soldiers have been badly wounded and have been buried thinking they were dead, but they're really alive, and they had pulled out their hair while they were in the coffin. Maybe I shouldn't talk about this. But the swoon theory said Jesus was so badly beaten and lost so much blood, but he did not die. They thought he was dead. They put him in the tomb, and then somehow he was able to, you know, come back to consciousness and had enough strength left in him to roll that stone away. And I imagine crawl out on his hands and knees for the little strength that he had and somehow get past the guards, because the guards are still there, get past the guards somehow and get to his followers and then try to sell this story that he had been resurrected and raised from the dead. When in all reality, if he had not died, he probably still would have died. And there's no way he could have done all that in the condition he was in. So again, the swoon theory, I mean, like, again, I just don't see that as being very possible. And then the stolen body theory, that somebody stole his body. And again, possible, but again, who has the motive? Again, the disciples would have the greatest motive, but they were afraid, as we read earlier, they were hiding for fear because the Jews, again, this is not SEAL Team 6. Judas wasn't even with him anymore. But even with Judas, they couldn't get this done, right? I mean, we just know that he was still not good enough to get this done. And so stealing the body, the Roman authorities had no motive and the Jews didn't have, there's no good way to figure this out. The best way is what is being said is that he was resurrected. That's the best answer, but you have to deal with the empty tomb and nobody has a good way to deal with it except to say what everybody is proclaiming and what they saw is really true, that he was resurrected. So these are the theories that they tried to use to say that he was not resurrected and to come up with an answer why he was not in the tomb. All right, so let's get to the last one here, the rise of the church. We have to deal with this. This is another great evidence that Jesus is alive, is the reality of the church that has been growing for approximately 2,000 years, that is over 2 billion people strong, 30% of the population. It started with the early disciples seeing the resurrected Jesus and then going out and preaching everywhere and people placing their faith and trust in Jesus to save them. In Acts chapter 2, verse 32, Peter preaching on the day of Pentecost says, God has raised this Jesus to life, and we are all witnesses of it. This group that was very fearful in hiding once Jesus was crucified is now, after he's resurrected, now out preaching the gospel, proclaiming it, even to their very death. What changes a person from being cowardly about what has happened to being bold enough to die for it? The reason is it's true. That they saw the resurrected Jesus, they encountered the resurrected Jesus, and it changed their life, and they went out proclaiming it everywhere they went. This is the story of Easter. This is what Easter is all about, the resurrected Jesus. It's not a lie, it's the truth. If they had stolen the body and they were lying about this, don't you think one of the 12 at some point would have recanted the story? They would have eventually told the truth. When you're being put to death, and you think about Peter was married, he had a wife, he probably had kids. These were family men that were risking their lives for the sake of the gospel, that Jesus had been resurrected. If it was a lie and they had stolen their body, surely at least one of them would have recanted the story. But all of them go to their death, continue to proclaim that Jesus was resurrected. This is what Easter is all about. This is Resurrection Sunday, that Jesus is alive. Let me close with this story. This is an old TV show years ago. Anybody remember Alfred Hitchcock? Let me see. See, I think even some of the young people, we got some young people that know Alfred. Yeah, it's still around. You watch those shows, it's a little weird. There's one story of his about the final escape. I don't know if you guys remember this one. I've seen this. It's about 22 minutes long. And so it's about a woman who gets convicted for having killed her husband. She goes to jail. And she doesn't want to spend the rest of her life in prison. That's what she's been sentenced to. So she's trying to devise a way to get out. And she noticed that there's one man in the prison that works for the prison, and his job is when the bell rings, it means somebody has died. One of the inmates has died. Yeah. Richard's always going, yeah, I know the story, yeah. And so he takes the coffin that the dead body's in, and he takes it outside the prison gates and buries it in the yard. And she comes up with this plan that when the bell rings, if she would sneak into the coffin, then this man would take her outside the prison, bury her in that with the person who's died, covered up, and that she had worked out a scheme with him that he would come out later when nobody's around, it's dark outside, and dig it up and free her so that she could go on with her life, and she was going to give him a large sum of money that would fix his eyes because he had a problem with cataracts. And so she had devised this plan and worked it out with this man, and this is how she was going to get her freedom back. A very interesting story. So what happens was the bell rings, somebody's died in the prison. So she goes secretly and jumps into the casket where this dead man is and closes the top in, and she's in there with him. And sure enough, a little bit later, some guys come along and they take the casket and she feels it moving. They take it outside. She feels it being dropped down into the ground. Then she hears the dirt kind of hitting the top of the casket as she's being buried in the light. And she's thinking, this plan has worked. I'm going to be free. And as she lay there, after they were done, she laid there and laid there and laid there and wondering, where is the guy who's coming to dig me up? They had this plan. It had been a long time. And she's thinking, where is he? And she's starting to panic because he's not come. And so she takes a match and she lights it to see who it is that's in the coffin with her. You guys know the story. it's the guy that's supposed to dig her up. And now she realizes that she is trapped in this coffin to die. The woman had placed her faith and trust in another human being who she thought could rescue her from the grave. But instead, he died and had taken her with him. Now, what the Resurrection Sunday is all about is we need to place our faith and trust in somebody who's not going to die and take us there with him, that has already gone to the grave, defeated it, and can take us someplace else. And that's the power of Jesus being resurrected. When we place our faith and trust in him, he doesn't take us to the grave where every person goes. He takes us beyond the grave to life everlasting. That's what Easter is all about. That's what Resurrection Sunday is all about. And I would encourage you, if you've never placed your faith and trust in Jesus to save you, to do that this morning. In fact, we had a young boy just yesterday place his faith and trust in Jesus. This family that's new here at Cornerstone, they came to our Good Friday service, and a part of the service raised some questions about it. They talked about it later that night. Saturday morning, he comes to his parents and says, "I want to pray and receive Jesus into my life." And that's what he did. Will you stand with me this morning as we get ready to pray? And if you've never placed your faith and trust in him to save you, to take you somewhere beyond the grave to a good place, heaven, spending eternity with Jesus and his Father, then I ask you to do that this morning. It's real simple for us to place our faith and trust in him. It was a lot for Jesus to accomplish on the cross. But would you pray this morning as we close our eyes and bow our heads this morning, would you take care of business with God? Would you just place your faith in him? Would you talk between you and God and say, "God, I believe, Jesus, I believe that you died and was resurrected. I trust in you. I trust my life with you. And I surrender my life to you. I want to follow you because you're the only one that's beaten the grave. You died, but you were resurrected. The evidence points to it, that we can safely and securely place our faith and trust in Jesus to save us. And when we do that, he does save us." Would you, right where you're at this morning with your eyes closed, would you pray that prayer between you and God? Would you invite Jesus into your life? Would you make a commitment to follow him with your life?